do them, working quickly and precisely. That's about the size of it.
I know a lot, Emerald said. I have been friends with Taniel and Carpool for about 8 years now. Carpool uses my spare mortuary rooms to practice her blood magic. I know about the Red Hand and your infiltration of the Black Hats, though he only filled me in on that last week. I do not know why you are still in the city, and I will not ask.
Mikhail didn't know how to respond. He winced as Emerald tightened the stitch.
Well, that's a lot more than I expected.
I am Taniel's eyes and ears within landfall.
You're a spy.
Indeed, I am.
Mikhail processed this information.
He had expected to be sent to a guy who knows a guy, not directly to Taniel's spymaster.
He realized immediately how dangerous it was for them to meet directly like this, and why Taniel had instructed to only meet his contacts in an emergency. If either Mikhail or Emerald were caught and tortured, they could reveal the whereabouts of the other.
"He didn't tell me,"
Mikhail said quietly.
"He wouldn't have."
"You were the only contact on his list that he said could be trusted implicitly."
Emerald paused his stitching and rested his elbows on the workbench before looking at Mikhail over his glasses and letting out a soft sigh.
"I apologize for being cold. You're not a stupid man, so I'm guessing you've already realized the risks you took coming here."
"I have."
"But since my job is to know things, I'm well aware of your break with the Black Hats."
Mikhail hesitated. Every bit of information that Emerald shared could be a weapon against either of them.
"You have eyes in the Black Hats?"
"I do."
"I'm not sure myself how bad it is," Mikhail admitted. "My companion, Hendris, followed me to a meeting with Taniel. Then the Dianais found our safe house, and she assumed that I'm working for both the Red Hand and the Dianais."
"Sloppy."
"Oh, no."
"No. I meant these stitches."
Emerald paused.
"But yes, allowing her to follow you was sloppy as well. I know this. There is a gold rose remaining in the city."
"Taniel told me."
Emerald went on as if he'd not been interrupted.
"I'm not sure which gold rose was left behind, but they are attempting to reform the Black Hats as a spy network to funnel information back to Lindit. Hendris has made contact with them. Most of the Black Hats are now on the alert and know to look out for you."
"Shit."
There went Mikhail's possibility of creating a schism within the Black Hats. He couldn't risk using their caches or safe houses now either. One chance meeting could get him killed, or worse, captured.
"Do I have any chance of getting back in with them?"
"That's not for me to judge," Emerald said. "But I do know that several Black Hats who remained behind were with Fidelis Jess when he died. They corroborated Hendris's story. They are very confident that you are a traitor."
"So much for that."
Mikhail closed his eyes, trying to ignore the stab and pull of Emerald's needle. He had a whole boatload of new enemies, many of whom knew what he looked like. The escape routes he and Hendris had put together could no longer be risked, which meant he'd have to figure out another way of getting Taniel's informant out of the city. If he could find her.
"Hendris thought I tipped off the Dianais, but I didn't."
"Any idea who did?" Emerald shook his head.
"Maybe it was just bad luck," Mikhail grunted.
"Probably," Emerald said. "The Dianas have managed to capture or turn a few bronze roses, which compromise safe houses. They've also increased their patrols and random searches since the bombing.
So, who is responsible for the bombings?
I'm afraid I haven't found out yet. There was another this morning. A cafe was destroyed when someone lit a fused artillery shell and rolled it among a group of Dainai's officers. Managed to kill about half of them, along with 9 civilians.
Mikhail swore. It was probably some misguided black hat cell attempting to use force to scare the Dainai's out. It was also stupid. Random killings would turn the population against the black hats and only serve to increase Dainai's aggression. That wasn't his problem anymore, though. His mind raced as he moved on, mentally writing off the black hats and trying to shift his way of thinking. He had to focus on staying alive while he found this Mara woman whom Taniel needed moved.
"Do you have any resources you can lend me?"
Emerald finished the stitches on one of the cuts. He dabbed away the blood gently with a wet cloth and smiled at his handiwork.
"I will give you whatever information I can, but I'm afraid information is all I can give you. I will not risk allowing you access to anything that will jeopardize my position here."
"Understood," Mikhail said tightly.
He swore on the inside. Emerald likely had contacts, escape routes, supplies, safe houses. All of that was closed to Mikhail, and it annoyed the pit out of him. But he understood why.
"How the pit are you able to run Taniel's spy ring from a public morgue?"
Emerald gave him a coy smile.
"I've run the Landfall City morgue for over 20 years. Under 3 governments. The occupying administration did the exact same thing Linda did when she took over the country a decade ago. They saw that I was running a tight ship and left me to my own devices."
"That's it."
"Public morgues aren't so different from sewage systems. People only notice them when they're run badly. Besides, I'm a widely published physician who's never had a drop of politics in his writing. I take care of the messy business of bodies, and in exchange, the government leaves me to my work. Why should any administration look closer than that?"
Mikhail decided not to ask what exactly his work entailed.
"Hiding in plain sight. Intriguing. What can you tell me about the Dainai's?"
"What do you want to know?"
Emerald started on the next cut.
"Who is in charge?"
"Wait, no.
Who is in charge of their counter-espionage? Who is the one giving out rewards for any black hat who comes over to their side?"
Emerald gave Mikhail a considering glance, his lips pursed.
"You're not thinking about doing something stupid, are you? If the Bone Eyes get hold of you..."
"I know the risks. Right now, I just need to know what I'm up against."
Emerald clearly didn't believe him.
"His name is Meln Yarrett. His title translates to something roughly akin to Minister of Scrolls."
"Scrolls?"
The connotation is probably closer to Minister of Information. I haven't been able to find out much about him beyond the fact that he exists. I have no idea how much power his title actually holds, or where he stands in the Dainai's hierarchy. He is apparently well-liked by his underlings. Other than that..."
Emerald shrugged.
"Right."
Mikhail thought over the archaic-sounding title and tried to picture the man who would hold it. In his mind's eye, this Meln Yarrett looked like a stern librarian or the headmaster of a religious school. Tall, with greying hair and angular features. He realized after a moment that he was picturing a red-haired Fidelis Jess.
"Anything else you can tell me about the Dainai's?"
Emerald didn't answer until he'd finished up the next set of stitches.
They are very efficient. They are preparing a census of the city to find out how many people remain and who they are. Their finest minds are studying Cressian technology. They want to upgrade their gunsmithing and metallurgy to compete with ours, and I suspect that they'll begin retooling Landfall's factories by the end of summer to upgrade their armies.
Mikael reeled. They're really moving that quickly.
They've planned for this, Emerald said. I don't know for how long, but it may be decades. They prepared for Phatrasta's armies and sorcery, and even for Lindet. One of the few things they underestimated was the military technology gap. They assumed that rifling and sword bayonets wouldn't play as big of a part as it did. If they eliminate that gap, they believe the war will be won by the end of next year.
Pit, Mikael breathed.
Don't get me wrong, Emerald continued. They're also almost stupidly cocky. Most of their generals believe this war will be over by winter, and then they can take their time figuring out the Godstones and preparing their armies for anything the Nine decides to throw at them.
He finished one last tug at the stitches.
However, I'm just passing on what whispers I've heard. I'm not a military man myself.
Mikael examined his arm. The stitches felt tight and uncomfortable, but they were as precise as if they'd been done by a machine.
I'm not either. I'll leave all that to Taniel.
And in the meantime?
In the meantime, Taniel said, thinking of Taniel's informant, I have my own tasks to accomplish.
He wondered how quickly he could even find this woman, and if the war would already be lost by then. Strictly speaking, the war wasn't between the Dionys and Taniel's faction of Palo. But if Phatrasta fell, Mikael had little doubt that the Dionys would crush any other opposition to their rule. The longer Lindet managed to hold out, the longer Mikael had to accomplish his task.
I appreciate the help, Mikael told Emerald. I need to get out and clear my head.
Emerald politely inclined his head. I hope I was of some use. Just remember that in the future...
Only in an emergency.
Precisely.
Mikael left the morgue, stewing on all this new information, and headed to one of the few remaining markets in the city, where he procured wood ash and vinegar. He returned to his safe house, where he created a mixture of the two and let it sit in his hair for part of the afternoon. When he washed it out, his hair was a shocking, dirty blonde. He carefully shaved the stubble from his face, leaving only a moustache. He practiced holding faces in the mirror, subtly changing the depths of his cheeks and the squint of his eyes, until he found something that he could keep up steadily in public. When he finally looked at the finished transformation, he barely recognized himself. He leaned over the washbasin, staring at himself in the mirror, taking several long, deep breaths before fetching his shoes. Removing the sole of the left shoe, he produced both his own gold rose and the platinum rose he took off for Daedalus Jess's body a month ago. He practiced his best confident smile in the mirror. Wearing a new jacket, he headed for the Capitol building. He approached the guards out front, asking several before he found one who spoke passable Palo.
"I'm looking for Mel Nyarit," Mikael said. Can I see him?
Only with an appointment.
I understand he wants information.
That is true.
And he'll pay for it.
Yeah.
Good. Take him a message for me. Tell him my name is Mikael Bravis, and I would like to help him dismantle the Black Hat presence in Landfall.
Mikael produced the gold rose and gave it to the guard.
When you tell him...
Show him this.
Chapter 14. The Mad Lancers rode hard after splitting with the Riflejacks, circumventing the Fatrastan army, and heading southwest across the countryside. Plantations seemed to stretch forever in every direction, broken only by the slight roll of the land and lines of willow and birch that divided the fields. Every plantation they passed told the same story. Labourers scurrying in the fields to try to get in an early harvest, while the households packed up everything of value and prepared to head towards safety. Stike wondered if safety was even an option at this point. Each new town was filled with panicked rumours that the Dianais had landed on the west, south, and east coasts, that nothing within 50 miles of the ocean was safe from their barbarity. A passing farmer claimed that Swinshire had been burned to the ground, while a cobbler said that Redstone itself was under siege. The Lancers took roads where they could, and forged their own paths across the vast plantation fields when they couldn't. At this point, Stike wanted nothing more than speed. They had 1,000 men and 3 times as many horses. Subtlety was not an option, and he had an itch between his shoulders that told him they were being followed. He called a stop on the afternoon of the third day to let their horses rest and graze, regrouping in a field next to one of the thousands of nameless roads that crisscrossed Fatrasta. Stike leaned in his saddle just off the road, letting Amrek graze without her harness. Selene lay on her stomach in the grass, feet bare, picking the heads off flowers with her toes. Normally, Stike would enjoy watching her foolery for a few quiet minutes, but he found his gaze drawn to the bone-eyed witch wandering among the men and horses. Carpole hadn't communicated in 3 days, sticking to herself at the back of the column, stopping frequently to scramble in the dust, and then riding hard to catch up. Sometimes she ranged on ahead with the scouts, sniffing the air like a bloodhound, her fingers pressing against the wind as if touching a pane of glass. Stike found himself drawn to her. She was amusing to watch in much the same way as Selene, but he had an inkling that her antics had a much darker purpose than childlike wonder, and he didn't like it.
"Have you found me a horse?"
Stike pulled himself away from watching Carpole and turned his attention to Selene.
"Still looking," he said. "Anyone catch your eye from our reserves?"
Selene plucked a piece of grass and stuck it between her teeth.
"You said I can't have any of the horses that someone is already riding."
"Right. Don't take a man's horse. Not unless you've paid him, killed him, or stolen it fair and square."
Selene pouted.
"And I can't steal from our men?"
"No, you cannot."
"Then no, I haven't found a horse I like."
The problem, Stike found, was that first-rate horses were rare. Most of the men in his cavalry were riding second-rate horses already, and there wasn't a single first-rate horse left that didn't have a saddle on it. Now, there was nothing wrong with a second-rate horse. They could be strong, fast, smart, dependable, but not all of the above. He wanted Selene to have a creature that wouldn't let her down. One she could bond with. He'd find it one of these days, but not among the horses they had with them. Until then, she'd ride with either him or Sunin.
"Colonel!" a voice called.
Stike looked up to find Zack and Marcus riding up the column toward him. The two brothers, in addition to their normal rags, tended to ride junk horses that none of his other lancers would spare a glance. Perhaps it was part of their scouting disguise, but Stike didn't understand it himself. A good horse was worth more than any amount of blending in. Stike nodded to the pair as they approached. Zack snapped a sloppy salute.
"Colonel, we had a question, sir."
"What's that?"
"Are we heading on a fixed course?"
Stike cocked an eyebrow.
"What do you mean?"
What's the direction we've been going? We continuing on for the next few days?
Why? Marcus cleared his throat.
Because, sir, you're gonna miss bad tenny whiles.
Stike perked up.
That's right. He's nearby, isn't he?
Yes, sir. He owns a plantation about 40 miles south of here. Big old building right next to a bend in a stream, surrounded by birches. You know the Cottonseed Tributary?
Stike pictured a map in his head, considering the location. He nodded.
A plantation sits on the land near the spring that feeds the tributary.
Oh, I think I might know the plantation itself. Not far from where we picked up Little Gamble during the war.
That's right.
Stike nodded to himself, thoughts turning.
Thanks for that. Where's Ibana?
Bit farther back, sir.
Stike headed that direction and soon found Ibana dismounted by an old stump. Her war horse grazed nearby, and she and Jackal bent over a map.
Since when do you use a map?
He asked Ibana.
It's been almost 6 years since I've crossed this part of the country, Ibana retorted. I'd like to know what we're looking at the next few 100 miles.
Stike couldn't fault that logic. He shouldered his way in to stand between them and squinted at the tiny roads and town names. It took a few moments for his eyes to adjust to the way the map was drawn, and he was soon picking out old haunts and prominent landmarks, orienting himself to their location.
We're here, Ibana said.
She pointed to their location, then drew an imaginary line with her finger, cutting north of Little Starland, and going straight to the Hammer on the west coast of Fatrasta.
Carpool says that her search is going to start somewhere around here. You still want to head straight across the middle of the continent?
Stike considered the question.
Jackal, are your spirits telling you anything useful?
Hard to keep up a good conversation with the dead while we ride,
Jackal responded, his voice matter of fact. Ibana gave Stike an irritated look as if to say, don't encourage him. She was not, she'd made it clear, a believer in Jackal's ability to talk to spirits.
However, Jackal continued, there are a lot of dead coming from the coasts, all the coasts. There's fighting in every direction. Swinshire is almost certainly gone. Maybe Little Starland, too.
Well, that's not good. Are we going to run into any serious enemies?
Neither Ibana nor Jackal seemed to know the answer to the question. Hesitantly, Ibana said,
if the fighting is still on the coasts, then we shouldn't have too much of a problem till we reach the Hammer. We might run into a Fatrustan field army, but they should be pretty preoccupied with reaching the front line. I think we're safe making a beeline to the Hammer.
She tapped on a dot on the map. Once we reach Bell Tower, though, things all get tricky. And if Lindit finds out what we're up to...
The idea did not please Stike. We'll just have to keep her in the dark as long as possible. Pitt, our own men don't even know what we're really up to. How is she going to find out?
Since when has Lindit not known exactly what was going on? Ibana countered.
Right. You remember our talk with Agerston?
I remember cleaning his blood spatter off me jacket.
Marcus and Zack say that Bad Tenny Wiles is about 40 miles south of our current position.
Ibana's eyes narrowed.
You want us to change directions?
No. Now, this is something I'm going to handle myself. I want you to keep heading toward our objective.
He turned his attention back to the map, poring over the roads and towns, before pointing to one about 80 miles to their southwest.
I'll catch up with you here, he said. In a week. Shouldn't take longer. If things get hairy, you can keep moving and I'll find you farther down the road.
All right. Make it quick.
Have you ever known me to linger over a kill?
Stike ended the conversation by rolling up the map and handing it to Jackal. He returned to Amrek and began to put the saddle back on, while Selene still lay in the grass nearby.
You're going to ride with Sunin for the next few days, Stike told her.
Selene rolled over, staring at him.
Why?
Because I've got an errand to run. I'll catch up with you later.
Oh?
Selene sat up.
You're going to kill someone?
Who gives you that idea?
Rumours going around the Lancers that you found out about some traitors. The ones who sent you to the firing squad?
Marcus and Zack and their damned loose lips. Stike swore under his breath.
Yeah, he answered half-heartedly. I'm going to kill someone.
I want to come.
You can't.
You took me into battle, but you won't take me to kill one man.
Stike finished with the buckles and ran his hand along Emrek's flank, then patted him on the nose. He thought through a dozen reasons why this was different, knowing that Selene would fight him about each one. Truthfully, he could move quicker and quieter without her. On the other hand, she was his responsibility. Handing her over to Sunin every time he wanted her out of the way felt a lot like how his father had treated him as a boy. The thought caused a sour feeling in Stike's stomach.
Fine, he said. Let's go.
They slipped away from the lancers and turned south, quickly putting a hill between them and the cavalry. Stike preferred to be away before anyone noticed, and back before anyone had the courage to ask Ibana questions. And they were almost a mile down the road before a horse caught up with them at a gallop. It was Car Pole. She put her horse in front of Amrek, forcing Stike to pull on the reins. Her hands moved in a quick, demanding flurry. He could guess what she wanted to know, but instead he just sighed.
I have no idea what you are saying.
Carpel snorted at him. She produced a piece of slate, like children in a schoolhouse might use to practice sums, and wrote out her sentence, showing it to him. Where are you going?
Business, Stike said. I'll meet up with you again next week. Stay with the Barner and the Lancers.
No.
What do you mean?
I'm coming, Carpole scribbled.
Stike looked down at Selene.
What is this? Are the two of you in cahoots? I got work to do, and I can't protect you by myself. Stay with the Lancers.
I don't need a bodyguard.
Damn it!
Stike rubbed his eyes, wishing she'd just turn around and go away. She made him uneasy at best, and he needed his mind clear for this. Having Selene along was already trying enough.
Ibana thinks you're with her.
I told her I'm going with you.
I don't take orders from you, girl, Stike warned.
Most people shied away when Stike became visibly annoyed. Carpole just smiled at him coldly. She wrote,
I ride with you or I follow. Choose.
Stike stared at her for a few moments, then ran his hand through his hair.
Have it your way. Let's move.
Chapter 15 Mikkel waited just inside the Capitol building for nearly an hour, trying to look nonchalant under the watchful eye of three Dainai soldiers. He found a blank piece of paper in one of his pockets and practiced folding it into various shapes, holding each one up for the purview of his silent guards. They continued to watch, unmoving, unresponsive, though Mikkel swore that he saw a hint of bemusement in the eyes of one of them. His patience was finally rewarded by the arrival of a middle-aged woman wearing a soldier's uniform without the customary Dainai's breastplate. She had fire-red hair and a gentle face that Mikkel immediately associated with an indulgent governess. She was unarmed, and her turquoise uniform was adorned with the stylized symbol of a dagger poised above a cup just above her heart. Crow's feathers dangled from her earrings. When she arrived, Mikhail's guard seemed to stiffen, and she examined Mikhail with a detached, unimpressed gaze.
"You are the one who brought the rose?" she asked in passable palo.
"I am.
Follow me."
Mikhail glanced over his shoulder toward the door, trying not to let his misgivings get the best of him. This was probably a terrible idea. He didn't know the Dianais, not their hierarchy or customs or laws. He didn't know how to navigate their world, and he was stepping in blind, hoping that this Meln Yarrett was smart enough to see the value in Mikhail's willing cooperation. After a few more seconds of hesitation, he followed the woman down the hall. They walked side by side past rows of offices. They passed soldiers and bureaucrats, officers and errand boys. It was a strange sight, seeing redheads, whom Mikhail had so long associated only with a palo, in the government offices. But other than that change, everything looked much the same as it did before the occupation. If there'd been any particular chaos here after Lindet fled, it had long since been cleaned up, and it appeared that no damage had been done during the fighting. The woman led him down the first flight of stairs and past several turns, then a whole other set of stairs down into the bowels of the building. Mikhail began to grow concerned as they left daylight behind and now had to depend on gas lanterns, and was about to ask their destination when the woman stopped and opened a door, indicating with a gentle smile that Mikhail should step inside.
"I want to see Meln Yarrett," Mikhail said.
"I know."
"Will I?"
"Please."
She gestured to the door once more, and Mikhail cautiously stepped into the doorway. The room inside was lit by a single lamp. It was small, almost claustrophobic, and it had a drain in the centre of the floor.
"Look," Mikhail said, "I..."
He was suddenly driven to his knees, a pain erupting from his left shoulder. His entire left arm went numb, his vision spotty, and he gasped out loud as he fell. He turned, attempting to scramble away and farther into the dank room, only to see the woman standing above him with a blackjack held casually in one hand and a wan smile on her face.
"What?"
Mikhail tried to ask. The woman lashed out at his chest with one foot, connecting painfully, and Mikhail tried to retreat farther, only to come up against the wall. He tried to yell or speak, but all that came out was a breathless whimper. She came at him with a blackjack, and he raised his numb left arm, only to remember too late that it was the same arm that Emerald had stitched mere hours ago. The blow landed hard, causing him to gasp once more. He dug into his pocket with his right hand, but had left his knuckle dusters back at the safe house. When she drew back to kick him again, he moved to one side to cause a glancing blow, then attempted to tackle her by the legs. The woman stumbled, nearly fell, then almost casually swatted Mikhail just above the ear with a blackjack. It wasn't even a hard blow, but Mikhail saw darkness for several seconds before his vision returned, and a horrifying pain shot through his head. He let go of her legs, wrapping his arms around his head, and attempted to curl into a ball to await the next blow.
"Devin Forgula!"
a man's voice barked. The next blow never came. Mikhail hazarded a glance through blurry vision. He saw the woman standing over him, turned toward the hallway, where two men had appeared. One of them was young, probably about Mikhail's age, in his mid-twenties, and he had a bald head and a short, lean frame. This one stared at the woman with outright antagonism. The second man was old, probably in his 40s, with a beer belly and two fingers missing on his right hand. The old man spoke, and it was obvious it was he who called out the name.
Devon Forgoola, he said again, his voice quiet but reprimanding. Geralt. The words were in Dianai's, but close enough to their Palo counterparts that Mikkel understood. The woman answered too quickly for Mikkel to follow. Get out, the older man repeated. The woman wiped her blackjack off on her sleeve and left at a brisk stride without looking back. Mikkel eyed his saviors, trying to focus on them rather than on the immense pain in his arm, head and shoulder. The older man watched Forgoola go, then gave an exasperated sigh and stepped into the room. He bent over Mikkel, pulling Mikkel's arm gently but firmly out of the way, and examining the side of his head.
His head is bleeding, he said in Palo. And his arm. Can you stand?
The question was directed at Mikkel, but it took his addled brain a moment to register it. Slowly he crawled to his knees, and then, with the help of the younger man, up to his feet. He limped after the two men. Neither helped him when he moved slowly on the stairs, but they did not hurry him either. They headed to the next floor, where they found an empty room. They were still in the basement of the Capitol building, but natural light came in through a high window, and there was a rug and chairs here. Probably the office of a low-level bureaucrat under Lindit's regime. Mikkel sat in one chair, head in his hands, watching blood drip from his arm onto the rug. He felt the eyes of both his new companions, but did not look up at them. He was doing all he could not to throw up.
Forgoola says that you're a blackout spy, the older man said. Is that true?
I was, Mikkel responded, stressing the second word.
But no more.
I understand that you're offering rewards and amnesty to blackouts who switch sides.
Switch sides? The man laughed. That's one way of putting it. Yes, that is the offer.
That woman, Forgoola, is not a member of my household, the man said, his tone shifting to anger. She serves another master. One who believes that enemies should be slaughtered rather than turned into allies. Someone told her about this little trinket, and she decided to take matters into her own hands before I could respond.
Mikkel finally looked up to find the older man holding his gold rose, turning it in his fingers to examine the details in the light.
You're Meln Yarrett? Mikkel asked.
I am.
The man smiled, and Mikkel could see that it was both tired and genuine. The smile of, as Silver Rose Blasdell used to say, a man who had to work for a living.
I apologize for letting Forgoola get her claws into you. That had to have been, he eyed Mikkel's arm, unpleasant.
That's one way of putting it.
Meln Yarrett gave a bemused snort. Forgive me, he said, gesturing to his younger companion.
This is Devon Tannic. He is one of my cupbearers.
Mikkel took a longer look at Devon Tannic, his eyes finally starting to clear, and realized something strange. Devon Tannic didn't have the subtle facial markers that differentiated the Dianai's from the Palo. His face was softer, his eyebrows farther apart, and his chin slightly weaker. If he hadn't been wearing a turquoise uniform, Mikkel would have immediately assumed he was a Palo.
What do you think of our new friend, Tannic? Meln Yarrett asked. He admits he is a spy.
Tannic had a startlingly deep voice that belied his slim, short stature.
He admits he was a spy. Once a spy, always a spy.
Perhaps.
Mikkel squeezed his eyes closed. The pain in his head was a dull throb now, which was only slightly easier to think through than the sharp pain from earlier. He knew that there were layers to this meeting. Forgoola, Tannic, Meln Yarrett, house elves and cupbearers.
There was more going on than was immediately apparent, but in his current state he could not guess what it was.
"I was a Black Hat spy," he said. "Before the invasion I was elevated to Gold Rose, which is the highest order within the Black Hats. The invasion came, the Grand Master was murdered, and then Lindit fled the city without warning."
"And now?"
Melniarrit made a tutting sound.
"What did you tell the soldier to whom you gave this rose?
That you would hand me the Black Hats within Lanfor?"
"That's right. I can help you dismantle their efforts here."
Melniarrit nodded.
"You certainly have my attention.
Let us start with this. What can you offer me, and what do you want in return?"
Mikhail forced himself to sit up straight, looking Melniarrit in the eye. This was now a negotiation, and he couldn't conduct a negotiation from a point of such weakness. He needed to appear strong, even if that appearance was obviously a sham.
"I can offer you the locations of caches and safe houses. I can help you track down Black Hats who've remained in the city. I can tell you how they work and how they think. I'll admit that I wasn't a Gold Rose long, but I spent years as a Silver Rose. I saw far more than the average Black Hat."
"And what reward do you expect for your aid?"
"People."
"What do you mean, people?" Tenik cut in. "Slaves."
The casual way Tenik said the word reminded Mikhail how foreign the Dianai still were. He shook his head.
"Not slaves."
This was something he thought about a lot since the occupation.
"You've been rounding up for Trastan citizens, the families of Black Hats who left the city with Lindit. It's part of war, I understand, but those people were abandoned by their government and their loved ones. They don't deserve to be hunted, tortured, and forced into labor camps or worse. In exchange for my help, I want you to let those people go."
Melniarrit leaned back in his chair, thoughtfully stroking his chin. He glanced at Tenik.
"You don't want riches? Power?"
"I don't have ambition for power. Riches," Mikhail allowed himself a smile, "I intend on proving myself very useful to the Dianai's government. The riches could come later. For now, I want those people released."
"You ask too much," Tenik said bluntly.
Melniarrit held up a hand to silence his companion.
"That's true. You ask a great deal. We gather these people because they themselves may be spies. But they are also useful as hostages and forced labor. We have hundreds already, and I imagine we'll end up with a few thousand by the end of the year, even without your help."
"Probably," Mikhail admitted. "But the hostages themselves have little value. The spouses and children of low-level Black Hats. Lindit doesn't care about them. Eject them from your territory. Hand them over to the closest for trust and army. Let them be a hindrance to your enemies and disguise it as an act of goodwill. There are already rumours that you're treating the Palo better than Lindit ever did. The people might begin to see you as a benevolent conqueror. If this war draws on, that itself will be a dangerous weapon."
Melniarrit smirked. "You make a very persuasive argument, Mikhail Bravis. But what you ask, it would be very difficult."
Mikhail gingerly touched the side of his head. It hadn't occurred to him that the Minister of Skrills might not actually be that powerful of a position. If Melniarrit was simply a hound used to find enemy spies, rather than a spymaster in his own right, Mikhail may have badly misplaced his bets. He needed a powerful patron if he was going to find Taniel's informant. "On the other hand," Melniarrit continued after a moment's silence, "I may be able to work with your demands. Tell me, why should I trust you? You've already admitted to being a spy. Shouldn't I assume you're still working for the Fatrastans? This could simply be your way to get into my good graces." There was a glint in Melnyarrett's eyes that Mikkel didn't particularly like. He swallowed, holding Yarrett's gaze.
"Give me the chance to earn that trust."
"Why?"
"Why shouldn't I just torture you for your information? Or hand you over to the Bone Eyes?"
Mikkel tried not to let his fear show at the mention of Bone Eyes. He knew what a Bone Eye was capable of, but that information was something he didn't want to let on.
"Because I came to you in good faith.
You offer a reward for a service. Is this the reward of which you speak? Because if it is, word'll get out sooner or later. Even sympathizers will grow wary of you, and rumours will spread that the Dionysus ministers are not true to their word."
Yarrett exchanged a glance with Tenek, tongue-in-cheek. "He has balls," Tenek said with a shrug, "but he's still a spy. What good is goodwill if it is used against us?"
"Goodwill is a double-edged sword," Yarrett admitted. Mikkel leaned forward, ignoring the blood dripping from his chin. "Do I seem like someone who would be more useful as a willing participant, or forced to aid you under duress?" Melnyarrett did not answer the question.
"Can you tell me where Lendit keeps her personal files?"
The question caught Mikkel off guard.
"I can't. Can you tell me where the gunsmiths fled, so that we might capture them and use their expertise to improve our armies?"
"I can't," Mikkel answered again. For all his bravado, he knew he was on shaky ground. Melnyarrett obviously had goals. If Mikkel couldn't help with those, then Melnyarrett might just hand him off to someone else. Someone like Forgula. With each answer, Melnyarrett looked increasingly doubtful. He sighed, shaking his head.
"Caches and safe houses are not enough. You're asking me to put a lot of trust in you, and in return, all I receive are promises. Give me something, Mikkel, and we can begin a relationship."
"Until then..." Melnyarrett trailed off. Mikkel racked his brain. His bluster about seeing a lot as a spy had been mostly that. Bluster. He certainly knew some secrets, and he had no doubt that he could be useful to the Dionysus in the long term. But immediate evidence of his good intentions? His eyes fell on the gold rose as Melnyarrett turned it over and over again between his fingers.
"Tell me," Mikkel said. "Did Lindit destroy the third floor of the Black Cat archives when she left?"
Melnyarrett stopped twirling the gold rose and looked up sharply.
Mikkel had hit upon something.
"She did not."
"Do you know what's up there?"
"We have an inkling. Secrets. A lot of them. I assume it's heavily warded. It'll take your privileged months, if not years, to break into it without destroying the contents. You want goodwill? You want trust?"
Mikkel took a fraction of a second to study Yarrett. His expressions and composure reminded him once more of Captain Blaisdell, and Mikkel decided to take a gamble.
"The gold rose is a key," he said simply. "It'll open the gate to the third floor. It worked for me. I don't see why it wouldn't work for you."
He silently prayed that Lindit's privileged hadn't had time to change the wards before they fled the city.
Melnyarrett looked down at the rose in his hand.
"Well, as simple as that."
"As simple as that."
The two Dionysus exchanged a glance, and Melnyarrett addressed Tenek with a clever smile. "Sediel will be furious."
"All right, Mikkel. Assuming this works, I will put you on a leash and let you go to work. You'll have freedom of movement, a household, protection, and the backing of my name. I'll see what I can do about the families that we have rounded up. The more results you get me, the more likely I'll be able to free non-combatants."
As simple as that,
Mikhail barely allowed himself to breathe. "Is there anywhere you want me to start?"
"There is. I have several hundred men combing the city to find out who's responsible for the recent bombings. We've captured countless Black Hats and partisans, and not a single person can tell me who carried out or ordered them. A household captain of the guard was killed less than an hour ago, and it has the ministers nervous."
"I'm not an investigator," Mikhail warned. "If it's not the Black Hats, I won't be able to help you."
"Then rule them out," Yaret responded.
Mikhail hesitated. He already suspected that the perpetrators were a Black Hat cell, but he didn't have the slightest idea where they were holed up or who they were led by. Perhaps the mysterious Gold Rose? Regardless, he had to say yes. Mikhail needed to gain stature within the Dionys as quickly as possible, lengthen that leash, and get to know the Dionys officials. The more he infiltrated their government, the more likely he was to find Taniel's informant.
"I'll see what I can do," Mikhail promised.
Chapter 16.
"Is spying always this boring?" Tenek asked.
Mikhail stood at a window in a stuffy tenement room in the industrial quarter of Lower Landfall. He gazed through a slit in the curtains, watching the entrance of a tenement across the street, while he listened to the sound of the mid-afternoon traffic. Before the war, this whole district was choked with smoke and the sound of carts, people, and factories. Now it was almost quiet, with the factories empty and the traffic sparse. Mikhail turned away from the window just long enough to glance at the man sitting in the corner behind him. Devon Tenek looked even more like a palo once he had shed his turquoise uniform for a brown cotton suit and flat cap, and he lounged on the floor as if it were more comfortable there than in a chair. Mikhail answered the question.
"Must have been the spies waiting, watching and listening. So, yes, it's always been this boring."
Tenek flipped a coin in the air and caught it. He slapped it on the back of his wrist, but didn't bother looking at the result before flipping it again. He'd been doing so for about 4 hours, and Mikhail wasn't sure whether to strangle him or find something to take his own mind off the tedium.
"Are you supposed to follow me everywhere?" Mikhail asked.
Tenek smiled.
"That's the idea. Your Gold Rose opened the third floor of the millinery. You have earned Yaret's trust, and you are now part of his household. But you're still a foreigner. For your safety, I am to be your bodyguard, guide, and assistant."
"Bodyguard, eh?" Mikhail muttered.
Tenek didn't appear to be a soldier, but he was lean and fit, and walked with the confidence of someone who knew how to handle a fight. Mikhail suspected that his job was less bodyguard and more guard. Mikhail wondered how long it would take for him to become fully trusted. Years, perhaps. He didn't have that much time. Until then, he could make use of an assistant and guide.
"What do you mean when you say part of Yaret's household?"
"Dionys society is based around households," Tenek explained. "A household revolves around a name."
He flipped his coin, caught it, and pointed a finger at Mikhail.
"You are the newest member of Yaret's household."
"Yaret is the name of the household?" Mikhail asked.
He kept his attention on the road and the entrance to the tenement across the street, but he listened carefully. He suspected that much of his downtime the next few weeks would be spent learning about Dionys society. He needed to enter and climb it as quickly as possible.
"It is."
"Ah."
Tenek felt around in his jacket pockets for a moment, then withdrew a card and handed it to Mikhail.
"This belongs to you. It marks you as a member of Yaret's household and entitled to the protection of Yaret's name.
If we are ever separated and you are questioned by soldiers, you can show them this, and they will escort you to Yaret's home.
Mikhail took the card and turned it over in his hand. It was on a heavy stock, coated in wax and decorated with a stylized golden trim. There were words in Dionyse at the bottom, and a red thumbprint in the center. He immediately wondered how hard it would be to counterfeit. If he'd gotten hold of one of these as a black hat, doing so would be his first concern.
"Handy," he said. "It is, but you should be careful."
Mikhail glanced at Tenek sharply.
"Of?"
"Remember Fogula? She belongs to a rival household. Yaret's protection is meant to be sacred, but in reality it is only as good as the power of his name. Fogula attempted to snatch you out from under us, and it's possible that she will do so again, if she thinks it's worth angering Yaret."
"Her household name is stronger than Yaret's.
Her household is stronger than everyone's."
"And whose is that?"
"Sedil."
Tenek's expression darkened.
"Kar Sedil is the Emperor's appointed ruler on this continent. Be wary of him. Be wary of the Bonice."
"Why?"
"I..."
Tenek hesitated, as if remembering that he was talking to someone he shouldn't completely trust.
"Just be wary of them. Prove yourself to Yaret, and in return you'll be taught all you need to know to be a useful member of his household."
Mikhail was surprised to receive such a warning from Adonais. They seemed so organized and in step that he'd expected the division among them to be minimal. Household rivalry sounded like something he could use. He would have to learn more about them.
"Do people ever change households?" he asked.
Tenek's penetrating stare told Mikhail a great deal. After a moment, Tenek answered.
"All the time. Marriages, trades, formal requests. Both household names must agree for it to be done formally."
"And informally?"
Tenek's expression softened, and he resumed flipping his coin as if carefree, but there was a glint in his eye.
"Concern yourself with finding this gold rose you promised your new master."
Mikhail slowly turned back to the curtain.
"Right."
A few minutes later, he heard Tenek get up and cross the room, coming to a stand just behind Mikhail and craning his neck to look outside. Mikhail stepped to one side, allowing him the view. Tenek asked,
"How does starting here help you find the person responsible for the bombings?"
"I thought you worked for the Minister of Scrolls," Mikhail responded, pulling away to get a good look at Tenek's face.
"I do. What of it?"
"And you don't know anything about being a spy?"
Tenek let out a soft laugh.
"You think Yaret is some kind of spy?"
"That..."
Mikhail hesitated, thinking of his conversation with Emerald. "That's what I was led to believe. Well, not a spy himself, but a spy master." "I don't know that word."
Tenek knew far more Adran and Palo than Mikhail had expected, and their conversations took place in both these languages as well as Dionyse. Mikhail tried to think of a Palo word for spy master, but settled on "one who commands those who watch your enemies."
"Ah, I see," Tenek said. "Yes, I suppose that works. The Minister of Scrolls traditionally oversees government information. History, census, data, that sort of thing. But Yaret wanted to be involved in the invasion. He worked to expand his position so that Sedil didn't have complete control of the war."
Census data could be useful, if it included the names of Dionyse citizens here in Phatrasta.
"The Emperor doesn't have a designated spymaster."
"I believe he does," Tenek recalled.
but they only oversee threats against the Emperor's person. Government spies were purged after the end of the Civil War, and we needed something new when we turned our eyes outward. Mikhail considered the information. He had 1,000 questions.